Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are in paper 48, section 5, which is old single column, page 550. Okay. So we're still chugging through this great big paper. Remember how it took us a whole session last time just to do the previous section. Same, you know, we're still in the same mode. We're going through one group of beings at a time. That, you know, in general, that they've given us some additional information about, you know, in previous papers, and we've been waiting for the full discussion here when we got to this paper. You know, they've collected all of these beings that you know, have a very immediate ministry to the Marantxa level, especially you know, if they have a very significant role. You know, on the mansion worlds, you know, they've collected all those descriptions here in this same paper. Okay, so the next group in line here are the so-called mansion world teachers, which we touched upon a while back. Remember how they are cherubim, sanabim, who are taking on a new role, and we'll see them talk about that here in the first paragraph. So let's just jump in and get going on it here.
Okay, the Mansion World Teachers. One, the Mansion World Teachers are a core of deserted but glorified cherubim and sanabim. When a pilgrim of time advances from a trial world of space to the mansion and associated worlds of Marantxa training, he is accompanied by his personal or group seraphim, the guardian of destiny. In the worlds of mortal existence, the seraphim is ably assisted by the cherubim and sanabim. But when her mortal ward is delivered from the bonds of the flesh and starts out on the ascendant career, when the post-material or Marantxa life begins, the attending seraphim has no further need of the ministrations of her former lieutenants, the cherubim and sanabim.
Okay, so yeah, just that one little thing. Remember how, unlike with seraphim, with cherubim, they actually have a separate name that they use when they want to be specific to distinguish between, you know, which one is positive and which one is negative. You know, in the pairing of angels. You know, so the aggressive one is the cherubim, and the retiring one is the sanabim. Okay, but in general, okay, remember how this works. If, you know, if you can recall, you know, way up in part 3, and they talk about this, the paper about the guardians of destiny. That initially, you know, we're in a group of mortals that are attended by a pair of seraphim, you know, and when they say, you know, exist, you know, this on the worlds of mortal existence, the seraphim is, you know, remember, actually, it's a pair, you know, even though they're using, you know, singular verb there, it's always a pair of seraphim. Okay, so remember, you've got it, when you're on your nativity sphere, you're initially in a group of mortals attended by a pair of seraphim. And there is a whole company of cherubim, 144 pairs of cherubim that are assisting that pair of seraphim. And initially, you've got when you're seven circlers, yeah, you're in a group of 1,000, and then six circlers, it's a group of 500. Fifth circlers, it's a group of 100. Fourth circlers, it's a group of 10. And then finally, when you reach the third circler, you've got your own personal pair. You know, and that's what they're referring to there, accompanied by his personal, right, or group, seraphim. Okay, now, they don't give us any specifics on exactly how to think about how they manage the logistics of groups. But, you know, certainly if you went all the way to four circlers where there's just a group of 10, you know, you could imagine that, matter of fact, it could be some just cataclysmic event that all 10 of those people might die, you know, in the same event. You know, so that definitely, you know, you could imagine that attendant pair of seraphim might, you know, be able to just keep on with that group on the mansion worlds, you know, until they get to third circlers and each have their own, each of those 10 ascenders has their own pair. And, obviously there's some possibility for group, but, you know, exactly how that works when you've got, you know, 1,000 seven circlers and, now, of course, you know, everyone is going to be being resurrected in a group resurrection, you know, when you're not a third circler yet, you know, so there is that issue. But independent of all the details like that, just the basic idea is that the seraphic ministry picks up where it left off from the nativity sphere on the mansion worlds, and whether it's group or personal. But the cherubim are not needed anymore. Now, and so if it's actually a group, like I said, that's 144 pairs of cherubim. You know, even if it's, we're talking about four circlers and it's just 10, there's still 144 pairs of cherubim, 288 cherubim, that wouldn't be, needed anymore once they're Maranja beings. But if you're a third circler and above, right, then the pair of seraphim just have a pair of cherubim. Right? And so the quote-unquote deserted cherubim would just be two, you know, in that case. Right? But there obviously could be instances where there might be a lot more.
There's 144? Does that make sense?
144 pairs of cherubim for...
Every 10 seraphim?
No. I mean, each group has 144 cherubim, whether it's a group of 1,000 or a group of 10.
That's all it has.
Yeah, right. There's one company of cherubim with the pair of seraphim.
Okay.
Okay, so one way or another, obviously there could be the case where those cherubim are no longer needed to facilitate the seraphic ministry to those material mortals, because they're not material mortals anymore. They're Maranja ascenders now. And notice, too, that, they are using the pronouns in the normal way, where they, but when her mortal ward, you know, so they refer to the seraphim as she's, you know, like they do, but, of course, don't literally think of them as male and females, because, of course, they're not. Or anything like, yeah, you know, right. Okay, but yeah, and then I was going to mention. See, then when they described the ascender, you know, as he is accompanied by his personal. Okay, now why is that? It's not because we're talking about a male ascender. You know, there aren't males and females on the mansion worlds either, right? You know, as ascenders.
It's not because that was correct English in those days.
No, has nothing to do with that. That's the least reason why it would, you know, be like that, right? I mean, there's nothing corrupting like that of, conventions in English, right, that would corrupt the truth of the revelation, right? The only reason they're using his and he, right, is because you're an ascending son, right? We're talking about, you know, you're ascending to the Father. This first phase of your universe career, you're an ascending son. Whether or not you were a male or a female on the mansion world, it's not that you turn into a male, right? It's not the meaning of saying son. Right? You're using son to indicate your relationship to the Father. Right? If they indicate your relationship to the Mother, right, they call you a child. You're a child of the Mother, you're a son of the Father. That's the way they, you know, they use the language to remind you of, you know, and initially you are God the Father seeking, you know, and so very much you are an ascending son. Now, once you're a finaliter, okay, now it's different. Now your more immediate relationship is to the Mother rather than to the Father. Right? But in the first phase, as an ascender, that's what we're talking about here, you know, they're going to use the he and the his when they're indicating that ascending sonship. You know, and of course, I shouldn't need to say it, but I'll remind you again when I say Father and Mother, talking about those different types of deity, you know, we're not talking about male deity and female deity. It has nothing to do with male and female. Right? It's trying to give you a sense of what kind of functioning that deity has relative to you. Does it function as an initiator, Father deity, or does it function as the upholder, you know, and totality attitude, the womb for the universe that you're in, for the one turning that you are in. Right? Is it an influence that's within and ubiquitous, so that it's mother-like, or is it an influence that's without, you know, and injected within, hence it's father-like. All right, you know, and so again, when they call angels she, that's because they're serving as agents of that mother deity ministry. That's why it's appropriate to call them she's. They're agents of mother, not agents of father. All right, let's see. Anything else we've got there? Let's see. When at the beginning there, when they say, when a pilgrim of time advances from a trial world of space, not immediately because there may be trials right here, right? But, of course there can be, but in the sense that they're about to describe with these mansion world teachers, that there's an initial trial to see how much of the initial things that that you do in your universe career you can get done on this first world, right? It's a trial in that sense of the extent to which you don't complete what you need to do initially, that's why the mansion worlds are there. All right, let's keep going here.
These deserted assistants of the ministering seraphim are often summoned to the universe headquarters, where they pass into the intimate embrace of the universe mother spirit, and then go forth to the system training spheres as mansion world teachers. These teachers often visit the material worlds and function from the lowest mansion worlds on up to the highest of the educational spheres connected with the universe headquarters. Upon their own motion, they may return to the former associative work with the ministering seraphim.
Yeah, to their former associative work. Okay, so two things there. First of all, you notice in the middle there when they pointed out that they don't just function on the mansion worlds, but they function throughout the whole hierarchy of the local universe, all the way up to local universe headquarters. Okay, so you might say, well, why do they call them mansion world teachers then? Mm-hmm. Right? Why don't they call them Marantia world teachers, say, or something like that?
Because it's a mansion world experience all through the universe.
The mansion worlds are just seven worlds. Right? And then you move on.
You are a mansion world creature.
No, Marantia.
Marantia, excuse me.
All right, see, that's the thing.
It starts with
Yeah, that's the point I was going to say. See,
rhetorical.
You know, you notice it's not Marantia, it's Mansion World, right? And so you've got the question of why did they limit the name? Well, if you think back, okay, we actually mentioned that in passing at the time when we were reading about the Third Mansion World. Do you remember that? How they mentioned that the headquarters for the Mansion World Teachers is on the Third Mansion World. Okay, so even though they are functioning throughout the whole hierarchy, they have a headquarters down on the Mansion Worlds. They're obviously there to help you, you know, right from your initial experiences and in the Marantia life. You know, they are there grounding the whole teaching ministry that they're doing throughout the whole hierarchy of the local universe, throughout your whole ascension through the local universe. Is just the fact that it's that it has this grounded in your beginning nature is demonstrated by the fact that their headquarters is there on the Third Mansion World. Okay, so you know, that's basically why they are calling them Mansion World Teachers, even though they are technically Marantia World Teachers, right? Because of where their headquarters is. It's on the Mansion Worlds. All right, so there's that. Okay, and then this whole bit of, remember they talked about this before, back when they were talking about the cherubim. You know, so you might even want to flip back so you can remember. It's back at the end of paper 38. The last three sections of that paper. You got one about cherubim and sanabim, and then about the evolution of the cherubim and sanabim. And then there's one about the midway creatures that ends that paper. And so that's, if you look on page 423 in the single column, just that reminder for, we mentioned this a little just recently, but get this in your head again. So remember, there's three different types of cherubim to begin with. There's Marantia cherubim, there's mid-phase cherubim, and then there's what are called ascension candidates. Okay, there's those two very horizontally functioning types of cherubim, the Marantia cherubim and the mid-phase cherubim. But then there's the highest type of cherubim, and it's those cherubim that are assisting seraphim, serving as guardians. Okay? So
not the other two.
Right? So we're talking about these ascension candidate type cherubim that are functioning with the guardian seraphim. Okay? And they get deserted because the seraphim are heading on up with you. Remember, they're following you all the way to paradise, your pair of seraphim. So it's these ascension candidates that get their first measure of ascension given to them by fiat, that embrace of the creative mother spirit that they just described. She's taking the way they are to begin with and upstepping their nature a notch. You know, she re-embraces them, modifies their nature up a notch. Okay, to what are being called Mansion World Teachers. Okay, and we mentioned this before, but look at it again. So in that last section in that paper. I think it's the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, ninth paragraph of section 9. Remember how we pointed to that before, how they were reminding you of the these beings that they reveal to us that are down, similar to us. You know, you move up from us. The next notch up is secondary midwayers. You see, if you look in that paragraph, see it goes. The serial association of mortal man, and then secondary midwayer is the next notch up, and then primary midwayer, and then Marantia cherubim, and then mid-phase cherubim. And remember, when we were talking about the Maharsha Companions, and that's why we looked at this before, they told us that the Maharsha Companions were in there in between the Maharsha Cherubim and the mid-phase Cherubim. That their nature is in a vertical hierarchy is in between those two types of cherubim. But you continue up with mid-phase cherubim, and obviously the ascension candidate cherubim that we were just talking about are a notch above mid-phase cherubim, and we now see there's another notch up from that of these mansion world teachers. Okay, and then just to jump ahead, they mentioned it here, you know, in this section about the evolution of the cherubim and seraphim, and they're going to mention it again. There's a subsequent embrace by the Creative Mother Spirit of those mansion world teachers that takes them up another notch. And when she lifts them up another notch, then they're seraphim. Right? So you can take this full sequence of mortal man, secondary midware, primary midware, Maharsha cherubim, midface cherubim, seraphim, and you can add some additional elements. You can add three things, you know, three other steps, intermediate steps in that sequence as you move up. Okay, and obviously, once they're a seraphim, those one-time cherubim, you know, they are going to, you know, end up being ascending seraphim at some point and heading up, you know, out of the local universe. Okay? All right, so that's what we're touching back on, what they introduced back there. They're giving us, you know, more of the story up here in paper 48. All right, let's see. What else do we have in that paragraph? So meanwhile, back to paper 48 here. You notice, and it says, you know, when they're talking about that modification, that embrace of the Creative Mother Spirit, it says, and then go forth to the system training spheres as mansion world teachers. So they don't have to go through some sort of training regimen. See, I mean, she modifies them, and then they're off to the races. Right? They get assigned. And they'll explain why here in a little bit. But then notice it says these teachers often visit the material worlds.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, all right. So we are going to be talking about, in the next section too, about angels that are doing things down on nativity spheres besides on the mansion worlds. All right, so mansion world teachers definitely visit material worlds. Let's see, and then that bit at the end, you know, upon their own motion, they may return. So, I mean, the Creative Mother Spirit doesn't, you know, downgrade them again, you know, but just to recognize, see, so some of the cherubim that are helping out seraphim, and you might even guess, it's probably pretty likely that when you're a third circler and have your own pair and just a pair of cherubim them helping them rather than a whole company, I wouldn't be surprised if that pair of cherubim might be mansion world teachers who have decided to go back and do some more work, you know, because that would be a kind of a higher job to be that pair for, you know, for a third circler and up. So you can have these mansion world teachers, you know, not being functioning as teachers, but as that upstepped cherubim, see, serving as assistants to seraphim. All right. And then here's what I was telling you were jumping ahead on here, the next thing they say.
There are billions upon billions of these teachers in Satania, and their numbers constantly increase because, in the majority of instances, when a seraphim proceeds inward from an adjuster-fused mortal, both a cherubim and a seraphim are left behind.
Okay, so you're reading that going, wait a minute, now I'm trying to understand. Up above, they were talking about personal or group seraphim. You know, but they then, you know, parenthetically up there said the guardian of destiny. And, you know, if you remember the details, you're going, well, wait a minute. Technically, they're not a guardian of destiny until, you know, they're working with a third circler, until they're personal guardians. You know, and so, you know, in between the lines up there, kind of, they were emphasizing this, you know, the situation where we're talking about third circler and above and just a pair of seraphim and cherubim, you know, with the ascender. And here you see it, you know, coming back again, that And their numbers constantly increase because in the majority of instances, when a seraphim proceeds inward with an adjuster fused mortal, both the cherubim and the sanabim are left behind. It's like there's no sign of any group sort of a thing here. I mean, they're even talking, you know, talking about the adjuster being fused. I mean, you know, with the ascender, right? We're not talking about, you know, going through a whole process on the mansion worlds and getting to fusion. They're just saying, going with the adjuster fused mortal and leaving the pair of cherubim behind, right? So here's what, you know, this is basically what, you know, what John was alluding to. Think about the whole local system. You know, don't just think about our world. Think about the whole local system. I mean, roughly two-thirds of the worlds in this local system now, there's 619 right now. I mean, about 400 of those are very old relative to the group of roughly 200 that we're in, right? I mean, those 400 are all way enlightened life.
They haven't been going through rebellion either.
Right. And then they're all way enlightened life. So for the, you know, for two-thirds of the worlds in the local system, I mean, you've got almost everyone on those worlds fusing on their nativity sphere, right? And the pair of seraphim are going with that adjuster fused mortal and leaving the pair of cherubim behind. Right, that's the majority of instances, right? Just because of, you know, the younger worlds are a minority. Right? Okay.
I have a question. Yep. You know, you see this quite frequently. You know, there's millions upon millions, or billions upon billions, or thousands upon thousands. You know, and you wonder, is it a billion times a billion? You know, or is it just a few billion? You know, because they use it a lot, you know, in various ways. And some of the times you think, well, gosh, there's got to be a lot more than just a million. So if it's millions upon millions, maybe it's a million times a million. Do you ever come figure that one out? Or is it vary a lot when they do it? Or is it more
They're just, you know, they're just giving you, you know, if they say thousands and thousands or millions upon millions, billions upon, they're giving you, you know, to the nearest three orders of magnitude, right? They're just giving you, you know, that, don't think about it being, you know, say, you know, 300,000 or something, you know, go up into the billions, you know, and we're not going to tell you exactly how many, but think more in that range, you know, of how many there are in a local system.
There's another part in later on in the Jesus papers, they talk about, you know, thousands of views with espouses. You remember that thing we talked about? And you think there'd be millions of thousands, but all I'm just saying, I mean, in terms of, and you wonder yourself, well, does that mean thousands of thousands? So you're just going to, I'm sorry, I mean,
just, you know, what they're saying is, you know, think in terms, you know, you mean it might mean 900,000, okay? But, you know, when you're going to describe it, you're going to use the word thousand, not the word millions. Million, okay? That's the idea of saying it that way, you know, that it's more in the order of thousands, whatever, you know, that whole range of three orders of magnitude, you know, as opposed to the three orders of magnitude with millions, right, or billions, or trillions. You know, occasionally they'll throw in trillions still, right?
That's true.
Right. Yep.
Isn't it part of what John was saying there about billions and billions? Like it says in the Bible, 70 times 7. If they wanted you to know the exact amount, wouldn't they put it in there and figure like that? This is just leaving it open that there's billions upon billions.
Well, and another thing too, right? I mean, besides them probably not being allowed to give you the exact number, I mean, this is it's a constantly changing number in this instance, right? Yeah. I mean, right. It fluctuates all the time.
Set number like 70 times 7.
Right. And when there gets to be too many, that's when they're taken out of the service like this. They're re-embraced by the, you know, creative mother spirit. And so, you know, it's a very dynamic, fluctuating
group. Yeah, because they give the exact number of how many are in an army or, you know, or that kind of thing. It's
right, right. But just, you know, this is all going to depend on how many they, you know, how many ascenders there are, how many they need.
But going back to what you said a minute ago, so let's say that there's 400 planets in the light and life thing, and they've got billions of people on each planet, you know, I mean, there'd be a ton of those guys.
Yeah, but again, remember, all those, people are, you know, a lot of them are waking up on Salvington, right? They skip over the whole scheme. I mean, again, you got to keep in mind, it's a very complex thing. It's not just a simple little linear thing, you know, People are skipping and coming back. As you know, some of those people that are jumping way ahead, they come back and help teach, right? You know, see, so.
Okay.
Right. Not to mention, who knows how many other orders of beings that they aren't revealing are also teachers, right? There's just, you know, all this stuff we don't know is in play. But all right. Anyway, right. So that's just, you know, that's the basics about them. That you've got this. You've got this endless source of potential teachers. You've got these cherubim that, you know, in many ways, the way they're initially made, they're just designed to be helping out on initial material worlds. You know, when that job is not available, you know, they don't just sit around and twiddle their thumbs. Right. They're modified and put to work in another role. Mm-hmm. Did you have a question? Okay. All right, so let's see what else they say here.
Mansion World teachers, like most of the other instructors, are commissioned by the Melchizedeks. They are generally supervised by the Morantia Companions, but as individuals and as teachers, they are supervised by the acting heads of the schools or spheres wherein they may be functioning as instructors.
Okay, the one kind of curious thing there is, I mean, the Melchizedek supervising him is obvious, but notice that there's this, the quote-unquote generally supervised, you don't know exactly what that means, but it's by the Morantia Companions, right? And we just, you know, we're going through that hierarchy, right? I mean, they're a lower order in that vertical picture we're talking about. So you see, once again, I mean, you know, don't be simplistic when we talk about vertical hierarchies like this. You know, the first shall be last and the last shall be first, right? I mean, you know, it's never that simplistic. I mean, there's a lot of beings that are quote-unquote lower on the totem pole, you know, in this hierarchy, that can do things that beings higher up can't do, right? It all depends on what job is in play, whether or not someone is, you know, is above or below in that circumstance. You know, a simple reminder, when they just said adjusted views mortal, I mean, you know, in that hierarchy, we were at the bottom, you know, but no one else in that whole hierarchy has an adjuster, right? So who's on the bottom?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, in terms of actuality, in many ways, we're on the bottom, but potentiality, you know, we're infinitely above them to begin with.
And then the last sentence is, you know, yeah. Normally, I mean, they're supervised by the heads of the schools, whatever they are.
Right. Yeah, and see, and that's an, I was going to mention that. Just notice, I told you, there's all kinds of beings that they don't reveal. And you can kind of see it there. You know, supervised by the acting heads of the schools or spheres. It's like, well, who are those? And there's all kinds of beings that they don't reveal that are involved in all this stuff. Okay.
These advanced cherubim usually work in pairs, as they did when attached to the seraphim. They are by nature very near the Morantia type of existence, and they are inherently sympathetic teachers of the ascending mortals and most efficiently conduct the program of the Mansion World and Morantia educational system.
Okay, that's pretty straightforward. You know, just the one thing maybe to notice is they are by nature very near. Yeah, the relativity of the word near, right? I mean, you know, when you're thinking about, I mean, there's obviously those who are more near, you know, to you at a certain level than they are, right? But you know, relative to beings beyond the hierarchy we were just talking about there, beings that are of a higher nature than seraphim, I mean, they're definitely nearer, you know, relative to some higher being like that. You know, we know that basically, you know, in our initial sense of our ascension, we're, as a Morantia being, we're moving up parallel to that hierarchy, you know. You know, at the same height as a secondary midwayer and then a primary midwayer and then, you know, et cetera. You're kind of just moving up until finally you're kind of at eye level in nature to a seraphim. You know, and then on up you go.
In the schools of the Marantia life, these teachers engage in individual, group, class, and mass teaching. On the Marantia worlds, Mansion worlds, such schools are organized in three general groups of 100 divisions each: the schools of thinking, the schools of feeling, and the schools of doing. When you reach the constellation, there are added the schools of ethics, the schools of administration, and the schools of social adjustment. On the universe headquarter worlds, you will encounter the schools of philosophy, divinity, and pure spirituality.
Wow. Okay, so in general, we won't talk about all of the details of those sets of three. But if you want to sit and reflect on them some, do it in the initial context that they're wanting you to recognize. We've been talking about it over and over and over again here as we've been going through the local universe hierarchy, right? At the local system level, that's the individuality level. At the constellation level, that's the associativity level. And at the local universe headquarters level, that's the unity level. Right, so let's take it top down. You know, see the philosophy, divinity, and pure spirituality. Right, the fullness of unity you're directly working on at that top level. Right, I mean, philosophy in its highest sense is the pursuit for universal unity. Right, the recognition of universal unity, and obviously, divinity and pure spirituality should make you think of the word unity. Now look at down at the associativity level of the constellation. What do you have? The associative things: ethics, administration, and social adjustment. Right? So three different phases of educating you relative to associativity. And so once you see that, now think about what it means to be doing the schools of thinking, the schools of feeling, and the schools of doing. Right. Initially, it's just about trying to develop you as an individual. Right? You've got to become a definitive individual first. Remember how we were talking about that when we were going through the Mansion world, and how they said when you finish up Gerasim, now you're definitively a Marantia individual. You've completed that individuality level. Right? These schools are schools of self-mastery. Right? Before you can do any associative things, you need to master yourself. Step one, right? What are you supposed to, this world is just part of that initial individuality level. We're in the local system level here, right? Your job here is not to be focusing on associativity and unity. Your job here is the first job, self-mastery. Right? The great man is not he who takes a city or overthrows a nation, but rather he who subdues his own tongue. Right? That's your first job. Not saving the world or whatever, but to master yourself. Right? Self-mastery. And they're giving you a little, in saying it that way, think about that mindful self. You have a mindful self that needs to be mastered. Right? There's nothing innately divine about the laws that mindful self is currently functioning under. You need to take a hold of it and master it. Right? There's nothing innately divine about your initial mindful self, no matter what Lucifer said. Right? It's not the case. Yourself needs to be mastered. Right? No exaltation of, my initial temperament is this, and I think that's what God wants me to be, and all the rationalization schemes that humans have. No, your job is to change that self. There's nothing innately divine about it. You need to take a hold of it and master it. It's not doing anything that it's supposed to be doing naturally. Right? It needs to be mastered. You need to find the reins, and you need to take a hold of the reins. And there's three different modes of functioning in your mindful self. The one thing your mindful self does is think. Right? It has that basic reasoning process that it's going through. You've got to master that reasoning process. It also is responding to external stimuli. right? There's sensation forms in your mind that are representations of what's in the external world, right? You feel those sensation forms, right? You need to master those feelings. Now that's something, right, that many, you know, where many people get tripped up. They're quite, they may not think that their thinking is innately divine, but they're pretty sure their feeling is innately divine. They can follow their quote-unquote heart.
Right. Yeah, right? That may be true. I remember my first therapy session, and the gal says, well, how do you feel about that? And I said, feel?
Right. In some instances, you know, you have to, first you have to change before you can adjust, you know, and control, right? Right. I mean, there have to be feelings from feelings to be mastered. Right? All of this has genetic differences. Some people have an initial bias to feelings. Some people have an initial bias to thinking. Right? But that doesn't mean either of those feelings or thoughts are divine. They're very crude, very immature, very primitive. They need to be mastered. Right? So there's whole schools devoted to how to properly feel. How to properly recognize, engage the sensation forms in your mind, right? And you've got all kinds of additional sensory modes, right? You know, so that you can very much master the complexities, all the details, all the different facets of these sensation forms in your mind, and deal with them properly, not twist them unwittingly, and you know, and hence respond to them inappropriately, and on and on and on. Right? So that whole issue of feeling. And then the other thing that's going on in your mindful self when it's functioning is you are forming intentions in that mindful self. Mindful intentions. Those intention forms manifest outward into the external world through your body. The doing. So you've got the thinking forms, the feeling forms, and the intention forms, the doing forms. There's three different schools for those three different modes, you know, and we can't even remotely imagine how complex each one of those actually is. You know, we're extremely crude right now, right? And you're going to be moving up and becoming more and more complex and requiring more and more mastery with more and more finesse all the time, right? You got to be able to do, you know, postdoc level mastery of intention forms and, you know, all these
getting
things.
Getting onto the next paragraph.
Okay? All right, so... all right, so just, you know, it's very important to, you know, see if you don't have that initial template of the threefold actuality where you know that it's all initially about individuality. I mean, just think about how confused we are about feelings. Right? I mean, you know, we're constantly wanting to somehow pour that out into the outer life. Right? It's like, no, your feelings are not for me. Your feelings are for you. And why do you have these? And have you mastered your relationship to those? Okay. I mean, think about, you know, some of the things here. I mean, schools of thinking, that kind of sounds kind of like primitive science, doesn't it? And the schools of feeling, that sounds kind of like primitive religion. Right? See, you know, we have these initial primitive thoughts about science and religion that are just, you know, related to this bias to the thinking side or the feeling side, you know, and we often talk, you know, we often use these false dichotomies to describe that, you know, that, you know, the thinking thing is, you know, is the brain, you know, and the feeling thing is the heart, right? You know, we use that simplistic dichotomy of the, you know, of the head and the heart, say, right? You know, and we often argue about, you know, one is bad and one is good. You know, it's like, no, neither are good or bad. They're just both immature and, you know, need to be mastered. You know, and they need to be brought together into a super additive consequence. Right? Eventually, You know, those initial tendencies to think and to feel mature into a genuine science and a genuine religion that come together in a super additive consequence of a philosophy. Oh, yeah, now I'm starting to really have a relationship to the local universe headquarters.
Right? Do you think there's a correlation between these three in each group?
That's one of the things that you can reflect on, right? Rather than you know, me just continuing to blabber about this, just, yeah, think about, you suppose the order of them is random? You know, think about, spend some time reflecting on, you know, individuality, associativity, unity in these threefold fashions as you move up. Okay.
So, Chris.
Yep.
So, yeah, Winston's wondering, you know, in the context of this Mansion World schooling, are we learning something about the rebellion and the defaults and the, you know, lessons learned and that sort of thing?
Right. I mean, remember, this is just the Mansion World teachers. Yeah. Right. There's all kinds of other teachers and, you know, and stuff going on too. Right. But in this context, you notice that the schools of administration, you know, which might have some real nitty-gritty details about rebellions and things like that, that's done up with the Most Highs, the constellation level, right? Because down at the level where there can be a rebellion, down at the local system, it'd be problematic for the schools of administration to be there. But in that mode, right, we're just talking about cherubim, glorified cherubim, but they're just cherubim. A rebellion comes along in the system 200,000 years ago. Think about the problems in those schools, right? Your teachers have joined the rebellion and are teaching you the new truths, right? Right. So, again, you know, it's a reminder, you know, that when you're in a, when you're, you know, in going through an educational regime here, right, you don't just turn your critical thinking off and just let that teacher pump whatever bilge water into your mind that he wants to pump, right? I mean, you need to have a discriminating ability. You know, not just for here, obviously, but see, even going up. I mean, you're not going to experience a rebellion, you know, at the local system level when, you know, we're ascending. But 200,000 years ago, your fellow ascenders had to deal with this issue. How many of them, you know, were listening to their Mansion World teachers, you know, that day in class and going, no, I don't think so, right? I mean, how many of them were like, you know, Van and Amidon and said, no, that's obviously ridiculous, right?
Got me in trouble a lot.
Yeah.
Got me in trouble a lot.
There's people that look at us and the very thing.
You know?
Yeah. Or reflect about it, and but you know, they look at us reading these ranch books. It's, they do not discover or recognize any of this is truth, and so quote unquote new truths.
Right. I mean, it's there's a lot of jaded people. There's been a lot of people that have claimed to have a revelation, claimed to have truth, you know, and they're, you know, they obviously didn't, you know. A lot of people claim to have absolute truth and things like this, right? I mean, you've got to be able to see through that, right? I mean, you know that I don't sit here and teach with such animation about what's in this book in my lap because I just want to believe something, right? I teach with certitude about it because I've put it to every test that I can imagine for, you know, decades. And it doesn't break, right? You know, they tell you how you validate a revelation through experience.
And yet you often say, you know, don't put, there's a difference between the facts and the truth, which, you know, oftentimes, as you know, is something you have to search for sometimes.
Right, right. I mean, yeah.
It's not
right.
Always just right out on the pages.
Right, and there's only facts on these pages. There's no truth on these pages. And you've got to find the truth that flows through the words, the facts, and that can be very tricky. You can easily deceive yourself, not willfully, but unwittingly, right? You can think that you have the truth, but, you know, all you have is your old worldview and its falsehoods, you know, that you've interpreted the words in, within. Right? So it's, you know, it's very difficult. But as you'll continue to make progress away from falsehood to truth in your relationship to the facts of the book if you just know that there's this great challenge in front of you, that there's nothing automatic about being related to truth.
And that leads right into the next paragraph.
Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, so just, you know, the reason that I said, you know, please spend some time reflecting is that's what you need to do. Everyone needs to reflect, develop enough reflective thinking skills on, of their own as an individual, like in those schools, to be able to find the truth in the book. I can't give you the truth. Truth is not knowledge. It's not a knowingness that can be given. It can't be turned into words where my mouth and tongue move and the air molecules jiggle and your eardrum jiggles. I can't, truth can't be given to you like that.
Though there is a spirit working on that for you.
Right? You have assistance inside to help you to find truth through fact, through knowledge, through the things that, that can be given to you by me or anyone else, your life experiences. But it's up to you, you know, to find the truth. Every individual has to find the truth themselves. Every cherubim, every seraphim, every archangel, every divine counselor, all by themselves has to acquire a relationship to truth. Yeah. Okay.
Those things which you might have learned on earth, but which you failed to learn, must be acquired under the tutelage of these faithful and patient teachers. There are no royal roads, shortcuts, or easy paths to paradise. Irrespective of the individual variations of the route, you master the lessons of one sphere before you proceed to another. At least this is true after you once leave the worlds of your nativity.
Right. Obviously, an awful lot of us leave here before we've learned much of anything. But again, that's why there's mansion worlds, right? You know,
what
kind of things? I mean, you could throw out one or two for the things that you failed to learn here that you could have learned.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, the easy. Remember when we were going through previous papers. I mean, we talked about the two biggies, right, that you may have failed to learn here, right? How to properly relate between the sexes and how to properly relate as a parent to child, right? Since none of us are males and females on the, you know, after this life, as we're ascending, we're one time males and females, but we're not males and females, and we're certainly not reproducing males and females, right? You know, obviously it's a lot trickier, like we talked about, to get those indispensable experiences after this life. So you ought to work on it, right? Here in this life, right? But, you know, if for whatever reason it doesn't happen, right, that's, again, another reason why there's material sons and daughters, you know, at the local system level, so that you can interact very intimately with their lives and get that, what you can only get, you know, through the interaction between those males and females, those material sons and daughters, and working with their children. And of course, you could also work with your children in the probationary nursery if you have some. But, because again, they're material children in the probationary nursery. So that's the thing. Those two things are very intimately tied to material. And when you go above material, to Marantia and spirit and whatnot, it's not there anymore. So you have to get it in relationship to matter. So that's another reminder of why matter exists. Right? That's the only means to acquire those types of relationships.
Yeah? So that just made me think, wonder, like in the nursery world.
Don't hurt yourself.
Shut up.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just had to give him a dirty look.
Pardon me, Lon.
People on the webinar are waiting.
Yeah. So they're male and female in the nursery worlds?
Right. Those are material children,
okay.
You know, but you remember they're not made reproducing, so they are, you know, fully male and female like, you know, we are.
Okay.
But, you know, they don't explain the details, but in some way, you know, they are roughly so, but they aren't procreating, you know, material kids.
It's interesting that they create the material sons and daughters that come from down, from above, down here, but when we go up there, we no longer have the male or female. That's kind of an interesting concept, you know, that comes down and goes up and it's not.
Yeah.
You know?
Right, see, so again, it's like, well, which is above and which is below? Right. I mean, there, you know, when all is said and done, there really isn't an above and a below. It's all one system. That has many different ways that it interrelates.
It's like that mighty messenger who says about this his or her one-time companion,
mm-hmm.
you know, who's been through a lot of the whole universe career
right.
with him or her. It doesn't say whether they're him or her, because I guess at that point.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, once they left their nativity sphere, they weren't male and female anymore. Mm-hmm. But, right. But you know, but even you know, after you're a finaliter and all that, I mean, forevermore, there's always the potential to play off of that experiential differential that one acquired as a female and one acquired as a male. Mm-hmm. We don't leave behind the experiential acquirements of when we were a male and a female.
No,
so those that nature is an internal part of you, and there's always a differential there that can have a super additive consequence. It's just you aren't an active male and a female anymore.
I love this next sentence about no royal roads, shortcuts, or easy paths to paradise. You know, it's like,
right. Right. Especially not, you know, you wake up.
It's really revelatory.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Especially not that you die and you wake up next to, you know, God the Father. Right. By magic.
Yeah.
Right. Right. That's really a royal road or a shortcut or whatever, right, or easy path. Right. Not even close. You know, infinitely antithetical to that thought is what is the reality of it. Okay, so see, and again, you master the lessons, remember? So it's about self-mastery. That's what it's about. So
and then they qualify.
Yeah. All right, so yeah, so that's, you know, yeah, and again, you know, they're stressing that those things which you might have learned on Earth, you know, again, just, you know, when they're talking about them as mansion world teachers, just teaching on the mansion worlds, you know, it's very much in that mode. That's the only reason the mansion worlds exist, is because you didn't get those things on your nativity sphere. And if you get all those things that you can get on the mansion worlds on your nativity sphere, you skip over the mansion worlds, right?
You master the lessons of one sphere before you proceed to another, kind of like the psychic circles where it has to be threefold, or it has to be, you can't just be real spiritual and make another psychic circle.
Right.
You know, you have to master that whole circle.
Right. Yeah,
I
mean, that's a good reminder that when you use the word mastery, you know, you're fundamentally talking about a cosmic nature that you're acquiring. You know, that mastered self is cosmic. It's not merely spiritual. Okay. You know, and you can see that, you know, at the schools again. I mean, you know, you're ascending up cosmic levels. Those are wisdom levels. Those are philosophic levels. You know, and you put a philosophic cherry on the top when you get up to the local universe headquarters. I mean, it's always fundamentally about the holistic nature of philosophy, of truth, right? It's not just about goodness or beauty, say, right? It's about the superadditive consequence of a relationship between the two. It's about truth in its full sense, in its whole sense. Right?
Yes. Yep. It probably feels good and satisfying, that mastery, just as we feel good and satisfied when we master something here.
Yeah.
Imagine.
Yeah. I mean, especially the more you definitively are sort of consciously aware of the functioning of your mind, you know, the laws of mind energy. Mind isn't so abstract like it is now. You mean you literally, you know mind energy and the laws of it. You know, you're studying them and learning those laws in school, and you know about the boundary conditions of your mind self that are imposed upon that mind energy. Once you know yourself as a physics like that, you know, the delusions of thinking that somehow there's innate divinity in this or something are going to go away, and you're going to definitely want to get a hold of that, master it, and it will, the joy that you'll experience,
exactly,
knowing that you have a hold of this now.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. It's like, now I can do something with this. This fits into the cosmic system. That initial thing I had didn't fit anywhere in the cosmic system. I mean, if you wonder why, you know, your life seems like it doesn't fit in anywhere, well, it's because there's nothing automatic about you fitting in somewhere. Only a mastered self fits into the cosmic system, right? If you fit in automatically, that would be the whole royal road shortcut whatnot thing, right? It's not the way it works.
So, you know, so there's the creative mother's creator son and the creative mother spirit. So those are, and they create. So it's not procreate, but they create. And then there's the material son and daughter that procreates.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
there's us that we procreate. Yeah, but when we get up there, I mean, that's what all of a sudden a light bulb came in my mind to think about this.
See, now you'll never be a creator, and you won't produce offspring, quote unquote, until, you remember, as a finaliter, when you get all the way up, you know, and done with your ascension phase of your career, as a finaliter, again, you're not a creator being, you're not God, so you can't create other beings, but you can, so you don't do that producing of offspring in relationship to the Father. But you can relate to the mother or the Paradise Trinity, right, and produce offspring through a process, a parallel process of trinitization. Right? You can produce creature trinitized sons.
But you do get a little bit of creation of having children.
Right. I mean, the creator is working through you. That's what procreate means, right? It's a creative act, but it's just not originating with you.
But that's the closest you probably get.
Right. That's as close as you get. It's just being, as procreating, having a creator work through you to create a being, right? The creators can't create, you know, your material children directly. They can only create those children through you, right? And he's like, well, why couldn't they just snap their fingers and grin? It's like, no, because that's there's laws. They've divested themselves of that ability. And then the more you understand the physics of the universe, the more you'll understand why it is that they couldn't. It's like, well, the creator son can make material sons and daughters, and those are pretty like me. Yeah, but not exactly like you, right? They're a notch above you.
Can't get us by that technique.
In terms of material offspring, a direct creator can't make any material offspring lower than material sons and daughters. They can't create down to our level below that, right? Directly.
Now that Michael is a master son, he can no longer create.
Right, right. He's got supreme deity in him now, so yeah, he can't.
Something unique.
Yeah, he can't participate in new things and stuff. I mean, yeah, I remember that whole issue.
Seems like a limitation compared to what he was before.
Right, I mean, again, you know, he's a lot of things, he can do a lot of things now that he couldn't before, but, you know, it's a reciprocal thing, right? He also can't do some things now that he used to be able to do. Right? I mean, you know, we're just kind of talking about that. You can procreate right now.
Yeah,
maybe, if you aren't, you know. But but you won't be able to then, okay?
Talk to your doctor.
You know what I mean. All right.
All right. One of the purposes of the Morontia Creer is to effect the permanent eradication from the mortal survivors of such animal vestigial traits as, oh gosh, procrastination, equivocation, insincerity, problem avoidance, unfairness, and ease-seeking. The mansion, the Mansonia life early teaches the young Morontia pupils that postponement is in no sense avoidance. After the life in the flesh, time is no longer available as a technique of dodging situations or of circumventing disagreeable obligations.
Okay, and before we get into the details here, it reminded me of the thing I was going to point out in the previous one. Notice the beginning of that previous paragraph. You know, it said, but you know, which you failed to learn must. Remember, I stress, you know, a lot of times I'll use must and say, well, that's kind of harsh. It's like, no, that's because the revelators use must. You got to face it. There's a lot of things that you must do. Right? And see, this is speaking directly to, you know, that instinctual reaction you have when you hear me use the word must. Right? Your animal vestigial traits don't like the word must. Right? Your animal origin nature does not like that word must. Right? Procrastination, equivocation, insincerity, problem avoidance, unfairness, and ease-seeking. Okay.
Those are different, though, than, you know, when Jesus, my hour is not here, you know, the things of,
It's one thing, right, it's one thing to be patient, right, or to recognize the flow of the supreme, and when it's the fullness, you know, of time in supremacy for something, that, yeah, I mean, that's a different thing, okay, right?
But even in our own lives.
But you will have an immediate instinct to rationalize,
right?
Right? That your procrastination is patience.
Yeah, but in some, but you have to be careful because sometimes it's right to be patient versus.
Right. Right. How do you distinguish? You must take delight in cultivating. It's going to take objective consciousness to distinguish between true and false, right? You know, these issues.
And sometimes you don't know ahead of time.
But you're working on being able to know ahead of time. You want to be able to learn by looking, not merely by leaping, right? By the time you have a mastered self, you don't need to leap anymore. You can learn by looking. You don't have to go through that oops process, right? You have foresight, you have insight, you have wisdom, right? And you don't have to learn by leaping. You can learn by looking. Okay, now
problem avoidance doesn't mean problem solutions either, right?
Right, of course it doesn't, yeah. But you will rationalize that you've solved the problem by avoiding it.
Yeah.
You know, just notice how you can quickly turn each of these, you know. Think about what your instinct is, you know, why you do these things. Now, one thing right up front, animal vestigial traits. There's a lot of stories that are written that involve these sort of things, and you know, the notion in those stories is, well, that's only human, you know, in contrast to divine.
It's only animal.
It's like, no, it's not only human. It's only animal, right? All these things are what you do as an animal. There's no humanity in any of these things, right? That challenge.
Other than the part of humanity that is animal.
No, that's the whole point, right? The human.
Well, as a human, you are a part of,
you're animal, right? But you're distinguishing, right? The human part is the part that's actually going upward. Remember again what the word human means. I mean, I keep stressing this because there's a lot of sentences in the book that you will corrupt if you don't remind yourself of what the word human literally means, right? It literally means up from the humus. Okay? Up from the dirt, up from the humus. That's what the word human means. You know, there's a lot of things that you do horizontally or downward. You're just an animal when you function like that. You know, like Let's say you use your third adjutant, your energy of loyalty, to be loyal to your baser instincts. What if you use that in a downward mode? Right? That's an animal behavior. Right? But if you turn it upward and actually use it, you know, loyalty to something above, where it can become the spirit of courage, that's a human thing. Animals see, you know, remember, animals technically don't have the spirit of courage. They don't have the spirit of anything. They might have the third adjutant, but they don't have it as the spirit of courage. They have it as the energy of loyalty. Right? And as an energy, it can be pointed down or up. And it's in your hands to master. I mean, material gravity is going to tend to take all of these arrows of this energy and flip them downward. You have to take a hold of that and rotate all those arrows upward. You have to orient your third adjutant upward. It's not going to naturally be upward. There's nothing automatic about courage. Courage is a choice in the moment, and it's human, right? Loyal, just mere
it's
loyalty.
Six or seventh adjutant, though. I mean, can't some animals have?
No, I'm talking about third adjutant. Third adjutant is loyalty.
Right. Some animals.
A lot of animals have loyalty. Right. Yeah, an animal can be loyal, but it can't be courageous.
I disagree with that wholeheartedly.
I thought courage was one of the seven adjutants also.
Excuse me. Right, you got to listen to what I was saying. Right, spirit of courage. Okay. That's a human designation for that adjutant.
Okay.
As an animal, you don't do the spirit of anything. You do the energy of something.
If that was true, then why do they say that the animals have the five spirits?
Right. They have the five adjutants,
yeah,
but they can't use them as spirits of something.
Why would it say that in the book then?
Those are the general names that they use for the adjutants. They're telling you they use the third adjutant, for instance. But you need to recognize, logically, could the animal manifest the spirit of something? No, it doesn't have any relationship to spirit energy. All it has is mind. It can't do.
The spirit goes right through the animal.
No, above. Spirit is above the animals.
It goes right through their body. They
No, it's above. Mind goes through their body, if you will. Right? See, again, remember, this is one of the things, you know, one of the challenges.
Yeah,
humans have always used the word spirit to indicate a certain functioning of mind. The revelators don't use the word spirit like that. Mm-hmm. Right?
Well, they call it mind spirits.
Okay.
It's the mother's mind.
Right. It's
that goes through.
Right. It's just the animals are just using mind part. You can potentially use the spirit, you know, ministry from the mother. An animal can't use the spirit ministry from the mother. So they call them adjutant mind spirits, right? Because they're a downward reaching thing. Right? The bottom is the mind. You know, that's what's reaching down. Okay? There's a spirit above that. You know, she's a spirit being, but she's projecting down from spirit to mind, and the animals are just using it as mind. But you're using it, the fullness, up that whole spectrum of mind, touching upon spirit. And an animal can't do that. The animal can't manifest the spirit of something.
It doesn't have that spirit
behind it. It can't manifest the spirit of that adjutant. It can only manifest the energy of that adjutant, and you manifest the energy too. Right? Remember, you know, the threefold actuality chart, that's why I put those annotations, you know, in there, like, you know, here with the third adjutant. Right? I mean, it's called the spirit of courage, but then parenthetically I have loyalty there, right, to remind you, right, that there's the basic energy nature. I mean, a dog can be loyal, but a dog can't be courageous. It's like, well, but I talk about my dog being courageous. That's because you can anthropomorphize it. You can imagine that it's being courageous, but it's not. Right? I mean, think about it. You know, if you're observing from the outside, how do you tell the difference between courage and loyalty?
No, you can't.
Right. You got to distinguish inside. You know, what's behind that manifestation of the energy of loyalty? Is there a spirit of courage that's manifesting as an energy of loyalty? Or is it just the energy of loyalty that's manifesting? And there's no person engaging spirit behind it. There's a mindful intention, but there's no spiritual motive behind that dog's actions. A dog doesn't have a spiritual motive, or a horse, or an elephant, or a dolphin, or whatever. They have mindful intentions, but they don't have any motives. They can't have motives because they don't have a relationship to spirit. See, and that's another thing. If you, the revelators, no human has ever known the difference between the word motive and intention. The revelators try to teach us that difference because we're constantly blurring them together and saying that something is that's just an intention is a motive. It's like, no, they're different things, very different things, transcendentally different things. And so that's the challenge, that to recognize that an awful lot of what we do is just an energy phenomenon. It doesn't have personality and spirit motivation behind it. It's just the way, you know, think about how profound the energy nature of the seventh adjutant is. The things that can do, just as the laws of the energy of that adjutant, does very sophisticated things. But that doesn't make it personal. Just because it's way super animal, you know, as an energy, but it's still not genuinely human, genuinely personal, until you take a hold of it and direct it. There's nothing self-directing about those energies. They're just energies. You have to direct them. There's nothing innately positive or negative about an energy. It's just an energy. It's what how you direct it that determines whether or not it's good or bad. You know, what you're doing. You know, what relationship to spirit does it have?
Yeah, but I'm just saying, in the book, it says spirit of the yes, adjutant mind, right. Spirit. So that's when you always say that. I've always wanted to say to you, I don't agree with that because that's not what it says in the book.
It's just, remember, the only thing that's in the book are facts. And I'm talking about what's the truth of those sentences, not what are the facts of those sentences. You've got to go beyond the facts, the words of the sentence. You've got to recognize what truth is flowing through there. And it's easy to do. You see the word spirit in the word spirit of courage, and you go, oh, well, I recognize that animals aren't directly spiritual, so I can't use that term literally to describe what they're doing. I mean, where did the revelators get those names? They got them from Isaiah, right? They're just playing off of those names in Isaiah. In that passage in Isaiah, is Isaiah talking about animals or humans?
I don't know.
Talking about humans.
What is the passage in Isaiah?
We don't want to go off too far off track here. We can talk about that offline. Right? I mean, you know, those aren't just names that are being taken out of Isaiah. Isaiah is obviously talking about humans. Talking about a human having the spirit of courage or a human having the spirit of knowledge.
See, the spirit has to modify his mind.
Because he's talking about the relationship of a human to God.
Your mind.
Right? That passage is about your relationship to God. Right? And Isaiah was describing, you know, a fullness of a manifestation of a relationship to the spiritual. You know, that a fully God-identified individual could manifest all these different, you know, spirit of wisdom, spirit of worship, spirit, you know. Right? Okay. All right. So back to this. You know, this is a very important passage. Let's get back to this here immediately. So, that animal vestigial traits. Okay, they talked about that in the previous paper. Right. I mean, the word vestigial, you know, just literally means footprint. You know, like a mark. You know, you leave a mark when you walk. You leave footprints. Okay, that's just another name for, like they said, the mark of the beast, right? Where you remember, you know, beast is not some goofy notion of the devil in some material, you know, fantasy, right? Beast is another word for animal, right? That's, remember, they were telling you, that's the whole point of the mansion worlds, is to get you beyond the mark of the beast, beyond your animal vestigial traits. That's why the mansion worlds are there. right? To get you beyond just what you do naturally as a minded creature. Because there's nothing innately divine about any of it. You have to take a hold of all of it and master it. And it takes tons of schooling and work to master the sixth adjutant, say, you know, effectively. You know, remember, you don't literally have the adjutants up there. You got Marantxa mind, but you're effectively mastering those different phases of mind within Marantxa mind.
I can't see why unfairness then would be an animal trait, because they don't know fair from unfair.
Right. You that's why it's an animal trait.
Why would it be?
Humans are fair. Huh? Animals are unfair.
Animals don't know fair from unfair.
Exactly. Not fair, unfair, right? You know, just notice, you see, you'll be naturally unfair as an animal because animals know nothing of fairness, so they're automatically unfair. You have to choose to be fair.
Let's not draw a bead on the dog. Don't worry about it.
Right? Right? You know, and the... You know, and the extent to which you call interactions among animals fairness, you're abusing the word fair. Right? And that's what we're getting at here, right? Okay, now, all of those are you know, pretty straightforward. I wanted to just speak a little bit directly about equivocation, though. Because in many ways, that's the most problematic in terms of why we have a fifth epical revelation at all. Why do we have this emergency revelation? It's not because of ease-seeking. It's not because of unfairness, you know, or these sorts of things. It's because of the problems that have resulted from our unmastered use of our relationship to spirit energy. Right? You know, and that basic... assumption that everyone makes that your relationship to spirit is innately divine, right? And if it feels good, do it, right? And one of the things that spiritual consciousness, that relationship to spirit,
feels good or feels right.
Well, the old expression is if it feels good, do it. I'm just quoting the old expression. But it is appropriate. That I mean good, I mean relationship to spirit, not right, which is a relationship to the triunity. Okay, I just mean a relationship to the unity part. Okay, equivocation. Now, what does that mean literally? Equal voice. Okay, think about, there's a basic instinct in your initial animal-like, you know, animal origin, spiritual consciousness. It loves the word equal, the word equality, right? And it immediately wants to think things like, everyone's opinion is equally valid. Yeah. Everyone should have equal voice. No, right? A human doesn't think that, because your human nature, your encirclement in the three cosmic intuitions, knows better. But your adjutant mind doesn't know better. I mean, the best you can do just with your adjutant mind, if you take it all the way up to the seventh adjutant, just as an energy, that's what actually gives you that energy instinct to go, well, on the one hand, but on the other hand, six of one, half a dozen of another, right? It's your seventh adjutant that gives you that initial concept of balance or proportion, right? That energy of symmetry that is the seventh adjutant, just as an energy, right? If you don't have an objective discriminator above that, right, all you've got is, I think everything has an equal voice. I'm going to codify in my governmental concept that all men are born equal. No, all men are not born equal. All men are created equal, like our Constitution says. But you know, it's not what a European Constitution would say. All men are born equal. No, they're not born equal. Right? That's equivocation. That's your unity consciousness blurring all the distinctions. Right? Equivocation is a really poignant one that you see all the time. People wanting to give equal voice to everything because your spiritual consciousness says that everything is equal, but it's not. That's not human consciousness. That's animal origin consciousness. That's an animal vestigial trait that you would think that we're all born equal and all have equal voice. We don't. Nope.
A popular expression of this is out of the mouths of babes.
Right.
Assumption that young innocent children are fountains of wisdom.
Right. We should listen to the children or something like this. You know, as if, right, children are born innately divine. And then all that can happen is the environment can corrupt them. You know, so we should, no, right? None of us, right? We're born ignorant, especially children, right? They're just empty vessels, right? And the only things that's inside of them is what, you know, the environment has put inside of them, basically, which might not be very wise, right? And it's certainly not going to be insightful, foresightful, right, I mean, I don't want to, go on forever on this, but I want to really stress this, to recognize that, it's these animal vestigial traits that a lot of times we proudly call human, and hence would never think of modifying them, because they're what makes us human, right? We glorify them in song and story, right? No, these are the reasons why there's an emergency. Especially when you get some spirit energy going so that you can actually get an emergency going. Glacial stuff like ease-seeking, doesn't produce emergencies. That just produces a very slow evolution. Right? To get an emergency, you've got to be falsely using your relationship to spirit. Right, so the whole, so you can see that these mansion world teachers are very much focused on these beginning issues. So another reason why it makes sense to call them mansion world teachers, because we can understand these issues that we have. We can't understand the issues we're going to have on the constellation level. That's so completely beyond our imagination, right? Again, in terms of what they can talk about them doing, it makes sense to call them mansion world teachers. It's related to the things that you need to clean up on the mansion world, your animal vestigial traits, the mark of the beast. Anything else there? They're just stressing again that the whole must thing, in a whole bunch of words, those last sentences. Time is no longer available as a technique of dodging situations or circumventing disagreeable obligations. Oh, yeah, that problem avoidance thing. Let me just mention that. The whole circumventing. And remember, in order to progress in anything, you got to go through the 8 steps of progress, right? Which begins effort, struggle, conflict. Yeah, it ends faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress, right? But it begins effort, struggle, conflict, right? And if you want to avoid that conflict, that problem, especially if you think you're really clever and you can go around it, circumvent, right? In this limited life, you might actually convince yourself that, you're really clever and you did go around something. But in there you learn that there's no end to the wall. The wall goes as far as I can see in every direction, and you can't get around it. You've got to face it. The only way to continue on is you have to go up. Right? The problem that you face that's so wonderfully analogized as a wall is that you haven't ascended enough yet. You haven't gone up enough yet. If you go up, there is no wall. You go over it. You overcome the problem. Right? That's what they're trying to teach you. They're trying to teach you to orient your nature upward so that you go over walls. To be human. to be up from the humus, not just in the humus as an animal, right? But to be going up.
And notice they say dodging situations is circumventing mm-hmm. versus, you know, as Jesus said, you know, everything must await upon its time. You know, it only ripens in time, and things like he kept on constantly. You know, you have to wait upon time for certain things to happen, but that's not necessarily circumventing or dodging.
Right.
But there is this thing about patience and time, and that's the real part.
Right. See, and that's, you know, and it's going to be a very complex thing to learn about how to do. You know, that's why there's all these schools, and it requires all this education. I mean, you've got to know. Okay, you've got a problem. Should I attack it right now? You know, and the answer may be no. That wouldn't. You need to attack the problem, but to do it now would be unwise. You need to attack it then, because then you can solve it, right? Because then other things are in play, right? And again,
he said sometimes those go away. Your problem, you know.
Right, like right, a lot. Yeah, sometimes they solve themselves and stuff, right? I mean, having the wisdom to know when you need to attack a problem and when you don't need to, or when, you know, that whole issue of at what point and in what context, right, the place and the time of it, all of that's going to take a lot of education for us to learn how to do it properly, right? And if you just use your energy of zeal, your sixth adjutant, relative to problems, the only thought you have is get a bigger hammer, right? Right? If you didn't fix the problem with that much zeal, get some more zeal, right? And that, you know, is going to most likely just make it worse. And we see that a lot. Spiritual consciousness has no sense of time. It's very impatient. You know, and so it sees a great thing that ought to get done, but it unwisely does it tomorrow instead of 5 years from now. You know, your rancher breeders have gotten themselves in all kinds of problems with that. You know, they see something that, yes, that should be done, and it can be done well 5 years from now. Well, I don't want to wait 5 years from now. I want to do it now. Well, you do it now, and it's going to cause no end of problem. Yeah, but I'm right. No, you're not. Because with your positive desire, you produced a negative result. That proves that you weren't right. Rightness involves a relationship to space and time, not just to you. If it just involves a relationship to you, what kind of righteousness is that? Self-righteousness, right? Yeah. Yeah. No. It has to be right with the cosmos, not with you. Okay.
Beginning service on the lowest of the tarrying spheres, the mansion world teachers advance with experience through the educational spheres of the system and the constellation to the training worlds of Salvington. They are subjected to no special discipline either before or after they're embraced by the Universe Mother Spirit. They have already been trained for their work while serving as seraphic associates on the worlds native to their pupils of Mansion World Sojourn. They have had actual experience with those advancing mortals on the inhabited worlds. They are practical and sympathetic teachers, wise and understanding instructors, able and efficient guides. They are entirely familiar with the ascendant plans and thoroughly experienced in the initial phases of the progression career.
Keep going. Yeah. I mean, that's all just pretty obvious. Just maybe, you know, one little point, a reminder. You know, they've mentioned that they're faithful. You know, like here, you know, they're pointing out that they're wise. You know, again, that's only true if they haven't gotten off the rails relative to their superiors. Right, those ones that joined the rebellion weren't so faithful or wise, were they? Right, you know, Lucifer wasn't so faithful and wise. Well, you know, and he's a lot more, has a lot greater intelligence than these cherubim do. And again, remember that for a lot of these beings that don't have the potential to reach up and grab a hold of an integrity at a very high level like we potentially can. They're very, you know, they don't really have much upreach at all. They're a very horizontally functioning being, right? And they're dependent upon the hierarchy. They're dependent upon their superiors. You know, and if their superiors go astray, or if they decide that they don't need superiors, you know, like Lucifer did, right, they don't have, you know, a natural integrity. So
how are they thoroughly trained in worlds like ours? I mean, you know what I'm saying? They've already been trained in their worlds of, while serving a seraphic associate in worlds of native. Like pupils, like us, in their native worlds.
Right. I mean, what they need to, they don't need to know so much what to teach, so they don't have to learn what to teach, but they have to learn how to teach, how to engage you in an effective way. You know, they have to learn the same thing that an adjuster has to learn. Right? The adjuster, when it's fragmented, you know, made by the father, doesn't know anything about experience. It's a purely existential fact. It has no experiential wisdom. It doesn't have any idea of what the most effective way it is to engage, say, Chris Halverson or John Hay. It has to learn that through experience and gets more and more effective. It's like, if you tweak the influence like this, it has a positive result in their mind. Yeah, but if you give them the influence that you initially thought would be effective, it actually produces the opposite result. Right?
An alarming result.
They learn the technique. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, that opposite thing. You know, we all learn that as parents early on. You know, you tell the kid to do the opposite thing of what you want, right? And then they'll do it, right? I mean, when they're engaging us initially and we're very crude, they have to use very kind of indirect means, subtle little kind of tricks to get us to get flowing in the right way. They have to learn the tricks of the trade, right? And they learn that just by living with humans for millennia, you know, millions of years, you know, working with seraphim, you know, understanding how the human mind works and, you know, how to effectively engage it, just like adjusters do. Yep. So like I said, remember I mentioned that they don't get any training, you know, in terms of like in the Melchizedek schools or something, right? Because they get on the job training before they became Mansion World teachers, working with the seraphim. They learn how to effectively engage ascending beings. You know, what tricks work with an ascending being to get a positive result. Okay.
Many of the older of these teachers, those who have long served on the worlds of Salvington Circuit, are re-embraced by the Universe Mother Spirit. And from this second embrace, these cherubim and seraphim emerge with the status of seraphim.
See, so like I said, so now you see how that works. You know, that they start down in the trenches on the first mansion world, working with ascenders just to huff their initial sphere, and they get more and more sophisticated in their abilities until finally they're able to teach at the Salvington level. And then after they've long served up there at the highest level, they can be re-embraced and made into seraphim.
And then be destined for...
Right, and then they can do whatever seraphim do, right? I mean, maybe they eventually be a guardian of destiny and end up in the... Yeah. Or anything that a seraphim might do, you know, they can now do because they're a seraphim. But see, notice the combination. The creative mother spirit can't just take them at any point and turn them in, you know, change them from a cherubim to a seraphim. They're giving you a little clue about the difference between the initial nature of a cherubim and the initial nature of a seraphim. That if you take the initial nature of a cherubim and you add a whole bunch of experiential acquirement, she can take that all, ball that all together, and you have the beginnings of a seraphim. This is reminding you about how much of an absonite-like nature there is in the finite, how much there is eventuation at all levels in the finite. So you have this initial existential nature of that cherubim. You add the eventually of a whole bunch of evolution, the experiential acquirement. You ball that all up. You eventuate that into a new foundation, and you've got a, the beginning nature of a seraphim. And then you can build seraphic experiential acquirement upon that new foundation. Okay? That's a measure of eventuation, see, that's going into that. Whereas a seraphim has all of that stuff just balled up into its initial nature. What it doesn't have is it didn't go through all the temporal details of that foundation. Right? It'll never have access to the experiential aspect of its foundation. You know, it's just there. Right? So when all is said and done, the cherubim is a seraphim now, but it's got something that no seraphim will ever have. Right? So it's a different flavor of seraphim. It's effectively by nature a seraphim, sort of energy, body, nature. Now,
same thing, right? Being in a way for mortals,
right,
who come from,
right,
the bottom like we are versus,
right. Right, there's a lot of very high beings on the Isle of Paradise that you'll see eye to eye when you're there as a finaliter, but you have something that they can never have. Right? You are your experiences at that level. All of that hierarchy from here all the way up to there, it is not just sort of bottled up into a new foundation, but you actually lived through all of that. It wasn't just put there by fiat.
That's why they say some of them envy you.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because there's no, doesn't matter how many eons, how many eternities they live, they can never have those experiences that you had. Right? They aren't available to them. All right, so now this next section is really huge, and we were just going to get started on it a little bit.
Okay.
But let's see, let's just make sure, did we get everything there? I think we did, didn't we? Yeah, all right, so.
Six, Mansion World Seraphim, Transition Ministers. One, while all orders of angels from the planetary helpers to the supreme seraphim minister on the mansion, Marantia worlds, the transition ministers are more exclusively assigned to these activities. These angels are of the sixth order of the seraphic servers, and their ministry is devoted to facilitating the transit of material and mortal creatures from the temporal life in the flesh on into the early stages of Marantia existence on the seven mansion worlds.
Okay, so here we are again. I wanted you to just read that first one so you might have your memory jarred. You know, when they said the sixth order of seraphic servers, remember how we've had this loose end for a long time, way back there in paper 39, when they talked about the seraphic hosts, remember there were seven different orders, and they talked about each of those as much as they could, except for number six, the transition ministers. Right, they talked about the supreme seraphim all the way down to the planetary helpers, like they just mentioned. But they've been waiting till now to talk about those transition ministers. And so we're picking up that loose end again. Like I said, it's just, a lot of these are sort of tying up these loose ends. And you can see, too, that unlike those other ones that kind of were very much in a hierarchy, these are sort of, and then there's also, right, these other ones that don't really, fit definitively into just a simple hierarchy. These guys working at the local system level, these guys, working at the constellation level, that sort of a thing. All right, so these are these transition ministers. Let's see what else is there. And the transition they're talking about, as they explained there, the transit of material and mortal creatures from the temporal life in the flesh on into the early stages of Marantia existence. All right.
You should understand that the Marantia life of an ascending mortal is really initiated on the inhabited worlds at the conception of the soul. At that moment, when the creature mind of moral status is indwelt by the spirit adjuster. And from that moment on, the mortal soul has potential capacity for super mortal function, even for recognition on the higher levels of the Marantia spheres of the local universe.
Okay, so now that's an important direct paragraph in a book that I've been stressing this some recently, I recall. You know, one of the big transitions that you've got to make when you're thinking about what the fifth epical revelation is telling us about our nature, and this whole bit of salvation, survival, those issues, right? That it's not your adjutant self that we're thinking with right now that survives. You know, your adjutant mindal self is a mortal self, and it's just that. It dies, end of story. You know, it's not a potentially immortal self. Like that other self that you have, that one that you're not conscious of, but it's there. Like they're saying, you know, that Marantia self begins here, not on the first Mansion world. It begins here, right? And it's that Marantia self that's resurrected, right? And because, see, effectively, you know, this mortal self may be living a life on this planet, you know, in a material way, but that Marantia self has already begun to live a Marantia life. That mindal self that's seated on that Marantia structure, your soul, right? That other brain, quote unquote, right? You know, that Marantia brain, quote unquote, that self is what's really ascending. Not the one you're thinking with right now. It's that copy of the savable aspects of your mortal self that is resurrected. And because there's already a Marantia self there, these ministers don't have to wait for you to get to the first Mansion world to start ministering to that Marantia self. They can minister here to that Marantia self. And, you know, if there's, you know, remember, the only way that that Marantia self and your adjutant self are connected is through the adjuster. There is a possibility for that Marantia self to influence your adjutant self through the adjuster. And hence, there's also a possibility for ministry to that Marantia self to come through the adjuster and into your conscious, you know, adjutant self. And it might manifest.
And you should be able to influence it.
Right. There's a potential, right? I mean, if you as you start to move up the, you know, the cosmic levels, the psychic circles, it can obviously start to work potentially, even consciously, the other direction. But initially, as you know, they're about to talk about, to recognize there's this potential for these transition ministers to be the reason why certain things manifested through humans on the planet. They ministered to the Marantia self through the adjuster. It got into the mortal self of that individual, and he wrote a psalm, say, right? Inspired by that ministry to that Marantia self. They're not ministering to the self that you're thinking with right now. So they don't minister to you directly. That they can minister to that Marantia self, and through the adjuster, you could maybe get some sort of a downstepped expression of that ministry.
So, other part in the book, you know, when you're talking about the soul a minute ago, not being conscious of it, they do say something that, you know, you can't, I think it's about that they can't really prove you have one, but everyone knows of the existence of their own soul or something like that. So,
right. In
a way, you have some sort of sixth sense or sense about that, don't you?
And
we talk about that being able to, you know, see. Well, that person has a great soul, you know what I mean?
You've got to know in context, when you see the word soul in the book, sometimes they're not talking about the literal Marantia structure. Sometimes it's soul, quote unquote. They're talking about the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind, you know, your adjutant mind. that's effectively your soul. Remember, it's that upper nature that's copied into the soul. So sometimes when they use the word soul, they're talking about that human, personalized self of spiritualized mind, right? You know, that you can have some awareness of. But just to recognize that's not technically the soul, that's what gets copied to make the soul, but it's not the soul itself. It's just your adjutant self, you know, the higher part of your adjutant self, that you can have some awareness of. Now, and the more you take delight in cultivating reflective thinking, having objective consciousness, the more you have an awareness of that objective soul-like self. But it'll be a long time until you, say, are a first circler and might get some direct awareness of the actual other self, that Maranja self. Okay, so, all right. And just the one little thing that they said there at the end about it here, you know, it has great potential to begin with. Unlike your adjutant self that has a definite low ceiling, right? That Maranja self, it may start out as just an embryonic Maranja self, you know, and not be doing anything too fancy to begin with. But the ceiling is very high on that Maranja self. It goes all the way up to the local universe headquarters level, right? It goes all the way up to the top of the Maranja nature, unlike your adjutant self. So that's why they're saying, see, even for recognition of the higher levels of the Maranja spheres of the local universe, right, that Maranja self has a very high ceiling.
Wherein eventually that Maranja self, your soul, whatever, becomes spirit when right. You get out of here.
Right. I mean, eventually you have a spirit identity.
Which is something right. different, right. even more
right.
Interesting.
Okay.
So,
you will not, however, be conscious of the ministry of the transition seraphim until you attain the mansion worlds, where they labor untiringly for the advancement of their mortal pupils, being assigned for service in the following seven divisions.
See, just note, you will not, however, be conscious, see? And so indirectly, you know, you might benefit, but not consciously. Let's read a little bit about the next one, okay. The first one here, yeah.
One, seraphic evangels. The moment you consciousize on the mansion worlds, you are classified as evolving spirits in the records of the system. True, you are not yet spirits in reality, but you are no longer mortal or material beings. You have embarked upon the pre-spirit career and have been duly admitted to the Maranja life.
So in other words, you're classified as evolving spirits in the records, not because of fact, but because of truth. Right? You're an evolving spirit in truth, even though you're not one in fact yet. Like you were saying, it's until you get out of the local universe, you aren't actually a first-stage spirit, right, in fact. But as a Maranja ascender, you are a spirit ascender in truth. Okay?
On the mansion worlds, the seraphic evangels will help you to choose wisely among the optimal routes to Edentia, Salvington, Uversa, and Havona. If there are a number of equally advisable routes, these will be put before you, and you will be permitted to select the one that most appeals to you. These seraphim then make recommendations to the 24 advisors on Jerusalem concerning that course, which would be most advantageous for each ascending soul. Wow.
Read that next paragraph, too.
You are not given unrestricted choice as to the future course, as to your future course, but you may choose within the limits of that which the transition ministers and their superiors wisely determine to be most suitable for your future spirit attainment. The spirit world is governed on the principle of respecting your free will choice, provided the course you may choose is not detrimental to you or injurious to your fellows.
Okay, so here's where, see, they're reminding you that these angels are helping you to come to terms with law, right? You know, you don't just have free will and love. You also have law, and your liberty is only in law.
You said law and love are just not the right.
Eventually, but initially, Yeah, right. There's a big difference between individuality and unity, between matter and spirit. Right. So there's a big difference experientially between law and love. Right. And here's, you know, you're coming face to face with law. You know, and like they're saying, you are not given unrestricted choice as to your future course. Okay, because you are living on one of the rebellion worlds, that sentence should make you feel tense inside. That should make you feel uncomfortable. You know, Caligastia has taught us all unconsciously, you know, about unbridled liberty.
You should be able to do whatever you want.
Yeah, you're not the boss of me. I can choose any damn thing I please.
Well, they said you can, as long as it's not
yeah.
out of the question.
Yeah. You can choose anything that's among the selections that they give you. Right?
So back to that, though, for instance. So what are they actually saying here, you know, rather than that part of it, that you, when they say optional routes, obviously that's not, you know, highways and byways. You know, but what they're really saying here is that at this particular stage, which is for the very big, basically the beginning of your universe career, you are actually choosing a route of whether I'm going to be an administrator or a minister or that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, obviously, none of us know anything about the details of what they're talking about here. But remember, they touched upon this before, yeah. Back in the mansion worlds. Remember, they told you that once you fuse, then you've got some of those big choices ahead of you. Here they said optional routes to Adentia, Salvington, Uversa, Havona, right? Well, Havona and the Isle of Paradise really come into play once you've fused. Right? And remember, they mentioned that about how these optional routes. You know, and here they're just giving you, you know, it's more than just relative to the central universe. You know, it's everything in between here and there, too. There's, what are we talking about here? There's a cosmic system. Okay? And you don't have any choice over what it is. It's a pre-existent cosmic system. What you're trying to figure out is how you fit into it. And there's no way an ignorant child of God can know such things. You're approaching the cosmic system from the bottom up, not the top down.
But right? If you choose to do God's will, isn't God's will in a way going to guide you?
No.
It isn't?
No, the will is not the way. The will is just the will. You have a will to be part of the cosmic system, but you don't have the way of the cosmic system from the Father, right? What are they teaching you? They're trying to get your mind into conformity with the universal harmony of God the Mother. She's the way. She's the cosmic system.
And right? The guidance you get is from these guys on helping
who are
you
teaching you about her way. Right? They're teaching you about the, you know, first you have to figure out who you are. You got to understand what the cosmic system is, and then you got to figure out how you fit into it.
She knows the right way for you, though, right?
Well, and all of the helpers. You know, these are angels. Mm-hmm. They're her helpers, right? Right. She isn't directly telling you anything, right? She's delegated all of this to her hands, right? They are helping you to figure out where you fit into the cosmic system.
Is this part of the adjuster's plan for your career when he first, you know...
Right, the adjuster obviously is involved in that too. Right, those who know, you know, are going to guide you into where you will want to be. Initially, you don't know that you want to be there because you're completely ignorant, but eventually, you'll discover you are in exactly where you should be and where you want to be.
That's a nice way to put it.
Okay, all right. So keep going here.
These seraphic evangels are dedicated to the proclamation of the gospel of eternal progression, the triumph of perfection attainment. On the mansion worlds, they proclaim the great law of the conservation and dominance of goodness. Wow. No act of good is ever wholly lost. It may be long thwarted, but never wholly annulled. And it is eternally potent in proportion to the divinity of its motivation.
Okay, so just a quick little thing there. Here's where they're talking directly about why they're called evangels. Right? The literalness of that word, you know, the EV part is the prefix EU, well, okay, you know, and you probably know that the word angel, you know, is the word messenger, right? You know, so literally it's well messenger is what evangel means, right? An evangel, a well messenger, well, yeah, they are the ones, the bringers, the bearers of the good news, right? The gospel, like they just said there. Dedicated to the proclamation of the gospel. And that's what, it's just literally what the word evangel means, right? Those who have the good news, you know, the well messengers.
The great law.
Okay. The triumph of perfection attainment. Okay, so that's why they're called seraphic evangels. You know, they are, see, they're, you want that perfection attainment thing. You have a will to perfection attainment, probably right now, very definitively. That's probably why you're, you know, one of the reasons why you're in the room here, is that you fundamentally feel that you want to consecrate your will that to that, right? To that perfection attainment. But you know not the way. Right? And no amount of will.
My prayer all the time.
Right. No amount of will gives you any of the way. Right?
It
takes a lot of work and lots of teachers to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, to master that self. A mastered self is the way. Right? And no amount of willing masters a self. You can squint and as much as you want, no amount of will adds one shred of mastery to yourself. Right? You're not a creator being. There's no fiat father thing that you can do to yourself to make it self-mastered. Right? It's a long evolutionary process that produces a mastered self. Right? Okay, so that's...
You can work on it. Right?
You need to start working on it right now.
You have to have a will to help make you work on it.
Right. I mean, you have to initiate it. That's what the father does. That's what the will does. Will initiates. It doesn't complete anything. It just initiates, right? Initiates it and maintains its activity, right? But it doesn't complete anything.
You want to keep going?
Okay, yeah. So let's, keep going here.
Even on Urantia, they counsel the human teachers of truth and righteousness to adhere to the preaching of the goodness of God, which leads to repentance, to proclaim the love of God, which casts out all fear. Even so, these truths been declared on your world.
Okay, before you read the 23rd Psalm in its proper mode there, just, you know, the goodness of God line and the love of God line, I mean, respectively, that's Paul and John, Apostles Paul and John. So between the lines, you know, they're suggesting they may have benefited from some of this influence.
I would think so.
Okay. And then we've got the 23rd Psalm here, made new.
The gods are my caretakers, I shall not stray. Side by side they lead me in the beautiful paths and glorious refreshing of life everlasting. I shall not in this divine presence want for food nor thirst for water. Though I go down into the valley of uncertainty or ascend up into the worlds of doubt, though I move in loneliness or with the fellows of my kind, though I triumph in the choirs of light or falter in the solitary places of the spheres, your good spirit shall minister to me, and your glorious angel will comfort me. Though I descend into the depths of darkness and death itself, I shall not doubt you nor fear you. For I know that in the fullness of time and the glory of your name, you will raise me up to sit with you on the battlements on high.
Okay, so, that is philosophy.
Yeah, so just, you know, think about that in the context of these seraphic evangels are dedicated to the proclamation of the gospel of eternal progression, the triumph of perfection attainment. See, to appreciate message got bestowed into this individual's consciousness that wrote this psalm somehow or other, right? And they've restored it, what the original message was, not what the person heard, right, and could hold on to, right? But, you know, to actually have one of the Psalms restored in its original, you know, form, it's pretty cool. You know, more original than anything that was in the mind of this person, you know. This is what was in the mind of the angel, not what got into the mind of the person that heard it, right?
Yeah, he recorded what he heard.
Right, I mean, because just the fact...
Well, why don't you read the next sentence?
Well, yeah, I know, but just the fact that there's such a huge difference in the details between what's on the page here and what's in the 23rd Psalm in the Bible, that's a reminder of how unmastered yourself is.
However, don't you see the truth in both of them?
Of course. That's the whole point. You're just making my point. Right, the truth is there, but the fact is not. Right, a mastered self could acquire the full facts of this psalm, not just the psalm in truth, but the psalm in fact. Right, and all the person got in fact was a very tenuous shadow. He had the truth. Right, the truth is obviously there. You can immediately tell it's the 23rd Psalm, right? When you start reading it, even though it doesn't say the Lord is my shepherd, you know it's the 23rd Psalm. Yeah.
Well, the traditional 23rd Psalm, I have an emotional relationship to it. For this one, it challenges me to intellectually.
Right. Right.
And it doesn't feel right.
Right, because this is the person heard a religious passage. He was given a philosophic passage, see, but he couldn't receive a philosophic passage because he didn't have a philosophic mind. Okay, right.
Couldn't retain it word for word, but. Well,
right. Why couldn't he retain it word for word?
I couldn't remember the
because
whole thing
he wasn't an adequate personal living philosophy. He couldn't assimilate it.
You don't think he couldn't write it down? I mean, could you remember it one time word for word?
No, again.
Just.
No, remember, you got to keep it in context here. The adjuster is talking to you all the time. Do you hear what the adjuster is saying? No, because you cannot hear. It's not that you don't have a pencil as a time to write it down, and you're hearing exactly what he's saying. You cannot hear what he's saying precisely. You do not have the mind. If you believe that an evangel or your adjuster can speak to you and you can hear exactly what he's saying, that's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. That's believing that your mind is innately divine.
So what is the next two sentences?
Right, okay, so read the next...
That is the story whispered
right.
In the night season to the shepherd boy. Doesn't say whatever.
Just read it.
He could not retain it word for word,
right.
But to the best of his memory, he gave it much as it is recorded today.
Right. That's all. And just
so if you would come over to me and whisper that to me, and I heard you,
mm-hmm.
I probably couldn't have retained it word for word, but I may have written it down the way he did, especially in those days. When we didn't have a whole lot of writing and, no ways.
Right, but do you think the revelators are just telling, is this paragraph a disclosure of fact or a revelation of truth?
It's both.
Right.
I
But but the fact is easy.
Whispered versus.
Right. Again. The facts are right there and we can read them. We all understand them. The whispering, the retaining. But what's the truth of that paragraph? The paragraph tells you how he didn't get it, but why didn't he get it? You need to go to the truth of the paragraph. Why couldn't he retain it? Not how he couldn't retain it, but why.
Because he wouldn't have a good enough memory.
No.
No?
No.
He didn't understand it. He didn't have the philosophic framework built in his mind to have a place to put those thoughts.
You can't.
So which is more valuable, the fact of the words or the truth behind the words, like Gene was saying? He actually felt the truth more in what he did give us versus what came out of here, for him anyway. And I'm not saying it's the truth.
He had spiritual feelings from it.
Okay.
Right.
Which.
Right.
Or it affected him more. Let's put it that way. Right. I don't know.
Right. That's fine if you want to just have emotionalism, but if you want to have a religion, you need more than just a feeling. Now, do your feelings lead you Godward?
Sometimes.
No. It is your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Right? It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Right? So this question of, you know, which is more useful, the fact or the truth? Can you obey facts? No. You can only obey truth. Right? You'll begin to retain the revelation when you can relate to the truth of it.
So for me anyway, the truth behind this is very simple for me, which is basically, you know, God's there and I don't have to worry about it. In other words, God's there when I, you know, it's a comforting thing.
Sure, but we're not talking about the fact or truth of the psalm.
Oh, okay.
Well, we're talking about the fact or truth of
how it got here?
Of his reception. He could not encompass the wholeness of it. He got a hold of the unity, the spirit sliced through it, and put words to that we have, and you feel that spirit slice through it. But like Gene was saying, when you see the whole thing, you see how you have a three-dimensional structure actually, and all you got was the two-dimensional plane.
But maybe he couldn't translate the English into Aramaic, whatever it was.
No. I mean, again, the answer is
so
not...
So the fact is, it wasn't really given in this...
The answer is not equivocation. But right? See? Right. See, that's what we're doing here.
Okay.
Right? Just notice that. Right? That's a great example of that.
To me, this is one of the more beautiful passages in the whole book. It kind of, you know, when I read this, and then I read this, is what, you know, that it was whispered to him, saying, that's... kind of cool, I think.
Right. Really?
But yeah, and that is. It's wonderful. The psalm, as it's in the Bible, is fantastic. But we're trying to go beyond that and recognizing about what we're doing on the mansion worlds. We're trying to get a mind that can wrap itself around the three-dimensional nature of this, not just the two-dimensional nature of the psalm that's in the Bible and how it makes you feel. Right? You know, can you have a mind where you feel as poignantly when you read this as when you read the one that's in the Bible?
Sure.
But not now.
See, what? Oh, I ask yourself, what does it mean to ascend up into the worlds of doubt?
Yeah, what does that mean? Not how does that make you feel, what does that mean? That's what Gene is getting at. It takes philosophy to interpret that passage, to go beyond how it feels.
Or experience too, right? Yeah. I mean, haven't everybody ascended to the worlds of doubt? We all have, haven't we?
No, I think you descend to the worlds of doubt, don't you?
You
don't ascend to them.
I don't.
How do you ascend to the worlds of doubt? What? That seems illogical. Doesn't make any sense, right? See, it's full of challenges like that. You should find, through effort and struggle, you should come to a conflict there. It's like, wait a minute, I think there's a misprint here. I think it's supposed to say descend and not ascend. We should change that.
Is it changed in your book, Gene? You've got the book of changes. Don't give anyone
okay.
any idea.
Anyway. Right.
So I just finished this last sentence.
Yeah, so finish that last paragraph there.
These seraphim are also the evangels of the gospel of perfection attainment for the whole system, as well as for the individual ascender. Even now, in the young system of Satania, their teachings and plans encompass provisions for the future ages when the mansion worlds will no longer serve the mortal ascenders as stepping stones to the spheres on high.
Okay, so that's a really cool thing. So here again, they seem like they're doing lowly things, but no, they're also doing very lofty things. And so when they teach you, will they teach you in that fundamental threefold way that they tell you you need to be taught? Can they give you origin, history, and destiny when they teach you? Yeah, they can definitely give you destiny. They're working on the destiny part right now. And so when they teach you, that's inherently in their picture. They have the big picture. They have a vast worldview when they're teaching you, right? And one of the things you see to reflect on, there's an initial way that this restored psalm makes you feel. Can you go beyond that? Can you go beyond what is immediately poignant? Can you see how it is they who know and are working on the destiny have embedded the truth of the destiny into the words, right? Can you begin to develop a cosmic consciousness about this passage instead of just a spiritual consciousness? Right? That's the challenge I keep, you know. I mean, I'm not saying there's anything bad about spiritual consciousness. It's not a dichotomy. You know, if you have a cosmic consciousness, you have all of your spiritual consciousness, but much more. Don't be satisfied with just your spiritual consciousness. Don't be satisfied with just how your unity consciousness relates to this passage. You know, and compare the two, like Gene was bringing up. It will help you to differentiate your spiritual consciousness from your cosmic consciousness. The person who wrote the one that's in the Bible only had spiritual consciousness. He just took that part out of it, that essence of it, right? And put it down in words. And you feel it definitively, it's there. But there's so much more than you can have than just that. This passage has all that that has and more. And the more, and some of the more part is not immediately accessible. It's going to require a lot of reflective thinking in order to figure out why in the world is the sequence of words that sequence of words. What does it mean? Right? You want to take the things of the passage, combine it with the values that your spiritual consciousness can get a hold of, and produce a super additive consequence of meaning. Right? To go beyond value, to get to meaning, a philosophic consciousness, a cosmic consciousness, to live a life with meaning, right? Not to just live a life with value and how values make you feel.
But then there's the goodness involved.
Right.
You know,
that's the values and how they make you feel, how important it is that you can't go anywhere until you initially feel those things. Jesus came here to encourage us to take that first step, to feel the values. Because no amount of things is going to produce meanings. You've got to have values. You can't have the fifth epical revelation without the fourth epical revelation. It's just so important that the fourth is not an end in itself. It's a beginning. I mean, he was doing the will of the Father, the initiator. It's obviously just the beginning, right? What does it begin? It begins a journey upward into cosmic consciousness, into having more than just that relationship to values and the joy that that relationship produces in your mind.
Yeah.
The joy. Okay. Right. The joy is the beginning, not the ending. That's what you got to discover. Religionists throughout all of history have thought that joy was an end. No, joy is a beginning. It's not an end in itself. That's the potential.
So you want it, and
it never ends, right? You should be curious. What's the actual? If joy is the potential, what's the actual? What have I not experienced yet? Right? Okay. All right. Let's take a moment here.